And as I mentioned, our guest is Stephen Elliott. He's written for a number of publications, including GQ, Newsweek, Village Voice, San Francisco Chronicle, and The Believer magazine. He's also the author of four novels, editor of the anthology Politically Inspired. He makes his home in San Francisco, and is the author of this new book, Looking Forward to It, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the American Electoral Process. Picador is the publisher. It's out in the bookstore now. And in fact, he will be here in Champaign-Urbana doing a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock. That's 809 South Wright in Champaign. So people certainly should feel welcome to stop by, say hello, pick up a copy of the book. And here, of course, on this program as we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Mr. Elliott, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thanks. Thanks for talking with us.
Yeah. Pleasure. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, you got yourself a pretty brutal tour schedule here. I'm just looking over at your appearances. You were in Chicago last night. You're going to be here tonight. And then from here, you're going to Cambridge. And then after that, on Thursday night, you're going to be in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
When do you sleep?
When soon as the election's over, I'm going to go to sleep for a long time.
Okay. Well, how did you get started on this? The book, Looking Forward to It, essentially is a campaign diary. It's a reporter's notebook. It's on, you know, something like based upon your experiences trying to follow around candidates during the primary season and up through the conventions, trying to get some sense of what the process is all about, what they're all about, giving a behind the scenes kind of thing, the kind of view that often people don't get. And the only time we get it is if people like you, reporters, do this same sort of exercise.
Yeah. But there's some significant differences. Like, I worked for Ralph Nader in 2000. So I had a lot of guilt and a lot of things I had to think about. And so this was more of trying to figure out where I stood on issues, what was important to my generation, could I make compromises. So it's And also, I'd never written really nonfiction before. So this was less of a reporter's notebook and more of a personal journey, you know, trying to figure out my own politics rather than being, you know, some objective reporter, which can be kind of dry, that kind of coverage. This is more like personal and what's in it for me and people like me, you know, and how do these issues affect us directly.
So how old are you?
32.
So in this election, we've certainly heard a lot about efforts to get younger voters. And I guess I sort of think of that as maybe, I don't know, 25 and under. But maybe we can bump that up a few years. Get those people registered, get them interested, get them engaged, get them to vote.
Right.
And there's been a lot of emphasis on that, particularly, I think, on the Democrat side, but but also Republicans have been out there registering people as well. And so the big question is, first of all, the big question is for all of these new voters, whether when it comes to the day, they'll actually do it. You know, just how engaged they are, how interested they are, and whether or not that's going to make a difference one way or another. And what you continually hear from people, and just some of the reading I've done recently looking at this very issue, they're always going to be able to go out there and find someone, and often it's a college student who says, look, I'm too busy, I have too many other things on my plate, and I don't really see that my vote is going to make much difference. Do you think, in fact, that the youth vote, whatever that means, really will be a factor?
Well, it's interesting, you know. Like the book is very much geared a lot to people like that, because the book it's funny and it's narrative and it's not dry, like a lot of campaign books. And so I was really hoping to reach that generation of people that are maybe not as interested and say, look how fun politics is. Look how endlessly interesting this process is. But in terms of, you know, will they turn out? One thing I think about, like people say, well, Bruce Springsteen is not going to make that big of a difference, you know, because with these kids. And you know, what does it mean to make a big difference? How many of 500 young voters could change this election? 1,000 young voters could change this election. You know, in Florida was won by 500, or wasn't really won, but Florida was decided by 527 votes. What if we had 1,000 more young voters in Florida? You know, so people that think that they don't matter just because the numbers aren't huge have to realize just that, like, every person participating in this election can make a difference, you know?
One of the things that really struck me in reading your account of this kind of behind-the-scenes look at this whole, the whole goofy primary process is, first of all, that it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but that's not exactly new. That's not a great revelation. I guess the thing that I did find myself thinking was that wondering, is it the job of reporters who cover this to make it seem like it makes sense?
I think there's a lot of things reporters could do to make it easier. A lot of times they don't connect the dots. You see a lot of times where in order to be fair, and I kind of put that in quotes, where they'll interview one side, they'll interview somebody who's telling the truth, and in order to balance it out, they'll have to quote somebody who's lying, you know? And I guess the thing to point to there specifically would be the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, which was a group that was completely, discredited across the board in many major newspapers, and it was proven that all their major allegations were false. And yet they were still called and asked their opinion on things and quoted in articles and treated as if they were like an actual source. And that's kind of tragic. I'd like to see some things change in journalism, but I'd also like to see people taking it upon themselves to participate. And more, the bigger problem then, the news media not doing their job might be not enough people reading the news.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people need, people have a responsibility in democracy. When, you know, we did this program after I finished the book at the Democratic convention. I had like 2 months before the book came out, and I wasn't going to leave the campaign trail. So I went from writer to activist, which is kind of the logical progression of the point my book is making. And I organized a group of writers, and we did all these voter registration drives across Ohio. That was part one. And part two is that we're offering to give a phone call reminder to first-time voters and students in any swing state. All they have to do is request it from my website, and they get a live phone call from Dave Eggers or Tobias Wolff or Michael Chabon or any number of great writers. But when I was going across the swing states talking to all those students, I would always say to them, look, you know, you got to participate, and participation is good for both sides. People think, oh, if voter turnout was higher, then that would help the Democrats. But actually, if voter turnout was higher, both sides would field better candidates. If voter turnout was higher, in 2000, we could have had Bradley versus McCain instead of Gore versus Bush. You know, mm-hmm. So it's like the Republicans wouldn't go away just because there was high voter turnout. They would just field better candidates, and that's true for the Democrats as well.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Stephen Elliott. He has written four number of publications, including GQ, Newsweek, Village Voice. He is the author of four novels and hasn't really done a lot of, as he explained in the beginning, not a lot of journalism, nonfiction kind of journalism. But this book that we're talking about here is a process of his spending time following candidates around through the primary process starting in July of last year and continuing through the conventions this year. The book is titled Looking Forward to It, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the American Electoral Process. The title, I think, if I'm remembering right, comes from at one point you bumped into, was it Dean? And you
right.
said that
That's
you
right.
were doing some reporting and that you were hoping to talk to him. And, of course, he said, oh, I'm looking forward to it.
Right. I said when I, the very first day I got in the campaign in Iowa City and I met Howard Dean, I said, hey, I'll be spending some time with you. He said, oh, great, looking forward to it. And he kind of moved along, and that was that. And I thought to myself, what did that mean?
That's obviously all candidates are very excited to meet reporters and very excited with the idea, oh, yes, of course, I love your work, and we'll get to that one of these days. And
I'll tell you, that's more true of some candidates than others. You know, it was funny with John Kerry, because when you get on the Kerry bus, and also the Bush bus, I might add, they're just like, oh, we're so happy to see you again. And when you leave and come back, they're like, oh, where have you been? We missed you so much. The bus isn't any fun without you. But they don't give you any access to anybody that has any real information. And whereas Howard Dean, he hated the media. And because he hated the media, everybody kind of filtered down. And everybody was kind of like prickly toward the media in the Dean campaign. But at the same time, you got great access. You could talk to anybody, you know. But I think the reporters prefer the latter. I think they'd rather have no access, but but a lot of love than more access and no love.
You early on seemed to have some interest and enthusiasm for Mr. Dean as mm-hmm. a candidate.
Yeah.
Let me ask you in a personal sort of way, what about him appealed to you?
Well, you know, for me, I was coming off of 2000 and working for Nader and being very liberal and not wanting to make compromises. And so Dean was the first guy I thought, okay, he's a straight shooter. I can live with this guy. He's against the war, a lot of things like that. In the end, I think Howard Dean was not as great a candidate as I wanted him to be, and I think a lot of us, a lot of people like me who just were wanting any Democrat to kind of live up to our ideals, we kind of put that on Howard Dean more than he put it on himself, and he was never maybe as great as that. He was like a good candidate, and he was a sincere person, and he had some integrity, but he didn't have the kind of integrity that we maybe thought he had. He switched positions on Cuba, and then he started talking about letting Jesus in his life when he started going for the Southern vote, and it all became kind of phony. Not as phony as some of the other guys, but seemed kind of phony, and it's funny how you learn about these candidates, and of course, Howard Dean was against the war, but he never actually had to vote on it. And some of the other guys, I really started out really not liking Kerry and really learned to like him a certain amount. He was still a compromise for me, coming from a liberal background. He voted for the Patriot Act and things like that. But, you know, I started to like him. And also, you kind of start to get that with everybody, people you don't think you'll like. Once you meet them, and that you realize that they're human beings, you can relate to just about anybody on the campaign trail. And that's on both sides, too. The kids that work for Bush and the kids that work for Kerry and you know, the ground troops on all sides are so idealistic, the ones that are anonymous, that it's really heartening, even when you don't agree with their position, just to see them really participating in the process.
I think there was some criticism of the way that the media covered Dean in this respect, that early on the criticism was that the media had anointed this guy way before the first real tests of his candidacy, and then very quickly after the first couple of after the first caucus and primary, they said, "Well, the guy's going down in flames."
Right.
And I wonder whether you think that is a fair criticism, or in fact that was a description of what things really did look like at the time, that being in the beginning that it looked like this is the guy to beat. But then once we really got into the, you know, the grit of the process, that he fell apart kind of quickly, and that he truly just wasn't up to it.
Right. I actually think I have a lot of problems with the media. And the first one being that a lot of times the media is lazy and they put out press releases and they quote people that they know are lying. You know, like after the convention, or not after the debates, they go straight to the spin room, which is where all the people are just, there's nobody but liars in the spin room. To spin means to lie. So why would you go into the spin room and take quotes from people who are paid to lie for a living and print them in your newspapers and run them on your radio and TV when I'd much rather hear an interview with a swing voter in Ohio to get an actual idea of what happened in the event. So I do have a problem with the way the media covers campaigns. But I think in terms of Dean, I think Dean was going down, and he was anointed early, and I don't think the media was unfair to him particularly. I mean, they certainly played the scream speech quite a few more times than I was interested in seeing it, but he had already lost the caucus at that point. And if you were with Howard Dean, you saw that it was as if he was trying to lose. He did everything wrong in the final week before the caucus, and when he lost the Iowa caucuses, that was the whole game for him. He was not going to recover from that, and I don't think that was the media's fault. I think his campaign had fallen apart on a lot of levels in a lot of different places, like the various Perfect Storm outreach organizations and his internal struggles. So I don't think that the media had much to do with Howard Dean's downfall. They probably had a lot more to do with his rise, and he was maybe never really that solid of a candidate to begin with.
Hmm. When you in the beginning stages, if you think back to where we had, I guess I don't remember how many Democrats we had altogether, seven, eight?
Nine.
Candidates. And you looked at who those people were, you had to say that, well, you're certainly early on, you had to say, well, you know, who knows what's going to happen. But you had to say in that field, there were some candidates you would have to say would maybe be stronger candidates.
And some things were obvious.
You know, like Dennis Kucinich was, you know, not going to be the...
It's funny with Kucinich. You know, I really liked him. And I spent a day with him in December, a day or two, and we were driving around. It was just me. There was no other media with him. And we're driving this van, and our legs are touching, and then he shared his meal with me late at night in the middle of Iowa, and we had a real connection. But, yeah, he would not have been a great president. And other people like Gephardt and Lieberman, those guys, I think you just knew, you know, never had a chance. I mean, Lieberman was out of the question from the beginning. There was never any point at which it seemed like he had any possible chance. And his positions were so conservative that there really wasn't much of a distinction between him and George Bush. And so he just didn't offer anything to the party. And Gephardt, of course, had already lost. He had already proved, you know, that he wasn't the guy. So he was going to have a hard time. You know, so early on, it really, almost immediately, it was Dean and Kerry and Edwards and then Wesley Clark. What's interesting about Wesley Clark, people think that he was crazy for not competing in Iowa and that he threw away the election by making that decision. And Clark has himself uttered some things similar that kind of recognize that. But I actually think that the Clark strategy of waiting it out and then starting in New Hampshire was a brilliant strategy. And if Dean wins Iowa, then Clark becomes the anti-Dean candidate and it almost certainly gets the nomination. Hmm. So it was a brilliant gamble, and it lost, but I think the odds were in his favor. And just, you know, sometimes you do the right thing and it doesn't work out for you, and I think that's what happened with Wesley Clark. He could have, if things had worked out different in Iowa, which is something he had no control over, then he would have been in real strong contention.
We're almost at the midpoint of this part of Focus, and I hope, Stephen, you wouldn't mind hanging on just a second here, because we're going to have to take a moment here to ask people for some money, and then we'll talk some more.
People should donate to public radio.
Darn straight.
Radio is great.
We'll talk a little bit more with Stephen Elliott here in a second. It is the time. You know, if you're a public radio listener, you know a couple times a year we're going to be sitting here in front of the microphones and urging you to send us money. The rest of the time, we concentrate on doing our jobs, and in this particular case, I think what I try to do is, you know, do the best couple of interviews I can that day. And I appreciate the fact that I don't have to stop. I don't have to – if this was commercial radio, I'd have to stop periodically through the interview and say, oh, by the way, go out and buy some stuff and then get back to the subject. Well, we don't have to do that here. And I think if you listen to public radio and you listen to commercial radio, you'll be grateful that we don't have the commercials. But – that's possible only because listeners are willing to pay the bills voluntarily. They understand how important they are. So that's what the deal is here. This is time we try to remind you, your financial support is vital. We couldn't survive without it. And it's a time now where you can show you appreciate the programs by calling in and giving us some money. So 244-9455 is the number to call, not the number of the show. That's a different number. Jack Brighton is here in the studio with me.
Yes. And if I may make an understatement, I would say that elections are important to democracy. And after all, to make good choices on election day, you need to know something about the candidates and the issues. And really, that's our project here. You know, we're trying to give you access to the people who are running for office, something that you really don't get in many other places. I mean, you get certainly a lot of campaign commercials on television and so forth, but we think that democracy is best served by actual dialogue with the people who would like to represent you in whatever place that they're trying to get elected. And so we chase down these candidates. We will tackle them if we have to get them on air. And it's something that, as a longtime producer on the show, I spend a lot of time doing, and we all do. Martha Deal and Harriet Williamson, all the producers, put a great deal of effort, and really, it's not easy, believe me, to get a lot of these people on the air. But we try our best, and I think we succeed more than we fail. So If that's something that you value, and we certainly hope that you do, that you vote, that you pay attention to the issues, you listen to the show, and you find out a lot of things, please support us right now with your pledge call, 217-244-9455. That's the simplest way I can put it. We really need your pledge call right now to support this, what I think of as the informational needs of the democracy, this kind of interactive forum. Again, 217-244-9455. And someone who helps us with that effort, Kimberly Cronick, our outreach coordinator, is in our pledge center. I don't hear those phones ringing, Kimberly. What can you tell everybody to make that happen?
Well, we're waiting for listeners to be the first caller during the first break of Focus 580. Sherry and Beth and Heather, longtime volunteers, ready to take your call at 244-9455. This is public radio, and we rely on volunteers not only to voluntarily contribute to the station, but to come in and answer phone calls. These folks believe in the station. Focus 580 is one of their favorite shows, because as Jack said, it's interactive. It's an opportunity for you to have direct access to candidates, to speakers from around the world that you wouldn't otherwise have access to. It's not just one-way communication, it's two-way, and that's what makes us public radio, strong local radio. So please call in right now and make a pledge at 244-9455 and think about that access that you have to democracy, to supporting it, to furthering it, to asking the tough questions, to having access. Those are all things that you value, and we know you appreciate it. So give us a call. I also want to mention we have opened up the airwaves on Friday for a new segment called The Public Square, where you as a listener can air a commentary on any subject of your choosing. So you get to pick the content that you want other listeners to hear. Every week we pick the content on Focus 580 and you interact with that material. Public Square is another way that we serve democracy, that we serve you. So give us a call right now at 244-9455. Heather, Sherry, and Beth are waiting to take your call.
That's right. And I want to say that, you know, in commercial broadcasting, elections are a bonanza. They make billions of dollars from campaign ads, from selling campaign ads. So it's really a bonanza for certainly the commercial broadcasters. But what we want is for the election to be a bonanza for you as a citizen. So what we do, instead of charging the campaigns to put on their messages, we chase them down. We tackle them. Our producers actually get them in headlocks until we get them on the air. So, you know, if you support that kind of effort, this kind of, you know, important element of the democratic process, we need to hear your pledge call right now, 217-244-9455.
All right. Thank you both very much. We get back here to our conversation with Stephen Elliott. He is a writer and a novelist. He's done both journalism and fiction. He's written for Newsweek, Village Voice, San Francisco Chronicle. He's author of four novels. He makes his home in San Francisco, is now traveling around the country talking about his book, Looking Forward to It, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the American Electoral Process. It's published by Picador, and it is the result of his spending time on the campaign trail, following around presidential candidates starting in the summer, last summer, and going up through the convention. He, by the way, will be here in Champaign-Urbana doing a reading and book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore at 6 o'clock tonight. That's at 809 South Wright in Champaign. And anybody who's interested in meeting him, I'm sure, can turn out and say hello and pick up a copy of the book. And questions, too, here on the program are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, we have a couple callers here. We'll go to someone listening in Downs. This is line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have an unattributed source story, only because I can't remember where I heard this. It's about David Kucinich, but only peripherally, so just bear with me for a minute. Somebody who was an observer in the primaries noticed that Kucinich was getting a lot of audience response. More positive response, this person thought, than anyone else, and said to a reporter, why aren't you covering this? Why aren't we hearing that this is the guy who's really getting the audience response? And the response from the media was, if we did that, he might be the candidate. And I was appalled by this story. And as I say, I don't remember who it was. But is this something that the media does?
Well, let me...
Reporters
do?
Do they
think? There's some things to think about here. One reporter does not speak for the media.
No, I think this was a general. I think this was sort of a, you know, sitting around having drinks. And
Right, but you see what I'm saying when you say, like, when you say one reporter said this, that doesn't mean that the media feels that way. I think Dennis Kucinich got less coverage than he deserved. And part of that is because everybody travels with a front runner, and it, the second place person, it's an incredible drop. And so, like, when I was traveling with John Kerry in December, when he was the loser, I called it the death bus because it was so depressing to be on a John Kerry bus. John Kerry had five reporters with him on that bus. John Kerry in December was not getting significantly more coverage than Dennis Kucinich was. So I don't know if it's entirely fair. I thought Kucinich should have gotten more attention because they lumped him in with Al Sharpton and Carol Moseley Braun, and that was not fair because he had raised a lot more money than they had raised, but he had still only raised a fraction of the money the other candidates had. He had a smaller organization. You know, Howard Dean, nobody was covering him, and he forced them to cover him by building an organization and creating a movement. And I think Kucinich could have done some similar things. He was really disorganized. You know, he took all of the work that he did in Iowa, and he made a deal with John Edwards, an awful deal, where he essentially gave all of his non-viables. I won't go into the details of how the Iowa caucus works. Essentially, he gave all of his votes to John Edwards. He kind of got tricked out of his votes.
Yeah, and I'm not talking about David Kucinich specifically, necessarily.
Dennis Kucinich. I'm talking about
this attitude that was
right.
expressed here now, and I'm just asking whether this is a widespread attitude, that we cover the guys that we think, you know, should be.
And I think I am addressing that. I think the answer is that they cover the winners. They cover the people who are doing the best. Those are the people that get the bulk of the coverage. And Kucinich was great with the crowd. And I love Dennis. You know, I hung out with him. I have nothing but good things to say about him. And he is a real crowd pleaser.
So you're saying this is true?
I was saying it's true that he was a crowd pleaser, but his crowds were not that big.
You're saying it's true that the media decides who they're going to cover because that's who they think is.
Well, there's a number
viable.
Of factors. I mean, there's how much money have they raised? How many people are showing up at their rallies? It's not just that he's getting good response from people. It's are a lot of people showing up? I mean, is there a movement there? And I think with Kucinich, the answer is no. There was not a movement with Kucinich. There was not that many people going to his rallies, even though his rallies were fun and there was a real strong connection. So each media outlet makes their own choices. There's not the media makes a lot of mistakes, but it's more often from laziness than cynicism.
Okay, thank you.
All right, sure. Let's go to another caller here. Next up is Kankakee, line one. Hello.
Good morning, David Inge.
Yes.
And guest Stephen Elliott.
Right. Yes.
This caller has a couple of questions for you, Stephen Elliott. First, you suggested earlier in this program that greater participation in elections would result in better candidates.
Yes.
What mechanism might that happen? And second, have you had any contact with candidate for President of the United States, Michael Badnarik? And if so, what have you to say about him? Thank you.
I had no contact with Michael, but I did write quite significantly about a lot of the Republican challengers, like Dick Bosa and people like that, guys that were really unknown. I wrote about a lot of those guys quite a bit. So I don't have anything to say about Michael. In terms of better participation, one thing is we've got to make it easier for people to register. People should, like in Wisconsin, people can register up until the day of the election. There's no reason if they can do it in Wisconsin, they can do it anywhere. You know, there's no reason that Wisconsin should have better election laws than Illinois or anywhere else. And I'm from Illinois, by the way. I went to University of Illinois, so I say that in all fairness. I'm not a California person. I just teach out of Stanford now. Getting people interested and giving them making it easier for them to register. We should make it easier for people to register absentee. People should not have to go to the polls. They should be able to vote by mail like they do in Oregon. And finally, this might sound crazy, but I'm certainly in favor of mandatory voting the way they do in Australia, where if you don't vote, you get fined $50 or $100. Because, you know, when I don't have health care, your lack of participation contributes to my lack of health insurance and your indifference. You know, I don't mean you, I mean people in general. So
We need to take real steps. And a lot of the politicians in power fail to realize that their parties would actually be well served by better turnout because they're only thinking short term. They're not thinking long term. And so we need to make it much more of a priority to get people voting because that's what democracy is, participation.
Do you think if we required people to vote, though, that those people who are not voting now that would be mm-hmm. voting because we say it's going to cost you money if you don't vote, would they be making an informed choice or would they just know, okay, I have to go down there and have to do this? And
I would say there's a lot of the people that are voting right now mm-hmm. are not making an informed choice. And I think that people, if they had to vote, they'd be more likely to look into the information. And beyond that, they wouldn't have to vote for anybody. They could always choose no candidate. They would just have to fill out the paperwork, you know. So I'm not saying you have to vote for one of the candidates, but you've got to at least make your voice heard, because then if you say I'm not voting for any of the candidates, that also sends a message. But you have to at least, put a check mark on the paper, you know. And also trying to make the election just more interesting. It's all about how fun these elections are. You get out there, you get involved. And that's why, we put out in paperback right away, and it's only $14, because so we can reach out to student and young voters and say, look, you know, here's a really fun book that you can afford, and look how great the process is.
I'm curious, and would be interested in having you talk a little bit about Ralph Nader. Mm-hmm. Earlier in the conversation, you talked about how back in 2000 you were working for Nader.
Yeah,
About how, you know, everyone now will remember how he emerged as a somewhat contentious figure after that election. Some people blamed him for the defeat of Al Gore, which I think is not fair, but nonetheless he was blamed. And we can see how this time around in many places Democrats mm-hmm. organized against him to try to make sure that he mm-hmm. was not going to be a choice on the ballot, because they were afraid, whether true or not, that the same thing would happen this time around.
Funny, I wonder who's going to apologize to Ralph Nader when John Kerry wins by a large margin. You know, say, sorry for keeping you off the ballot, we thought it was going to be closer. I worked for him in 2000. I was just starting my career as a novelist. I hadn't made any money yet as a novelist. It was just after the campaign that I sold my first books. And I went to work for him. I literally worked for him out of D.C. And I got involved originally. I had stayed out of politics because I was raised a ward of the court in Illinois. And I was 14, 13 when I left home, 14 when I became a ward of the court. And I just didn't see a lot of hope for the state. And then I saw in California, when Prop 21 passed, which mandated all these children be tried as adults, and it was just this awful law that sends all these children to adult prisons, and I knew it was affecting the type of people that I grew up with. And I realized then that if I had participated, if I had really fought, I could maybe have stopped that from happening, because nobody was really supporting the bill. It just kind of passed. And so I got involved in prison reform in early 2000, and that led me to Ralph Nader and working for him. And then I hung out with him again. I have a whole chapter of the book about meeting Ralph Nader again and hanging out with him for a month, and really coming to the conclusion that, I don't have a lot of the really negative thoughts that people have about him. I am not supporting him this time. I think he's crazy to think that when he says he's not stealing votes from Democrats, I mean, that just defies logic. Obviously, he's taking votes from Democrats. But at the same time, you know, I respect his right to run. I came to the personal conclusion that he was this angry father. He was this guy who you could never live up to this guy. You can never do enough for him. And if you look, he has very few old friends. You look at some of the other candidates, they have these friends from way back. You look at John Kerry with all these people that were on the Swift boat with him, and they're still friends. And Nader doesn't keep friends that way, because he's so stern and unforgiving that I just came to this realization that, you know, I can never, this guy's an idealist, and I can never, ever live up to him. And that's kind of freeing. It's kind of similar, I think, to, losing your virginity. You know, like on the one hand, you're not a virgin anymore. On the other hand, you can have sex now. You know, once you like let go of that feeling, of that incredibly stifling idealism. that is ultimately not realistic.
When you look at some of the big issues in this year's presidential campaign, obviously the war in Iraq is perhaps number one, at least in a lot of
people's
minds.
Number one for me, yeah.
The Iraq war is very big. The war, what is come to be called the war on terror, and that you know, a lot of people means different things to different people,
yeah,
and maybe have a problem with what we've done. And then if you look, however, at the domestic issues, a lot of these things are the kind of things you would think appeal to a senior citizen such as myself, you know, people who are concerned about the future of Medicare and Social Security and cost of prescription drugs and things like that. And I guess I'm wondering, I don't mean to put you in a position of speaking for, you know, voters 30 and younger, but let's set the war aside. Mm-hmm. Do you have some sort of sense about for voters in these younger age groups, what to them is most important?
Well, I would say, as you mentioned, the war is definitely the most important thing to them. But setting that aside, the environment is a huge issue for them. I would like to see young voters more thinking more about the debt, the deficit, and the tax cuts, because those debts are not going to go away. They're going to have to be paid, and they're the ones that are going to pay these debts. So I wish that the youth voters would focus more on that issue, but they don't realize, because they haven't been in a position of paying off massive national debts, the consequences these deficits are going to have for them. What happens, you know, you can't have a war and cut taxes. Nothing is free. I mean, obviously you can, but ultimately all bills come due at some point, and it's the youth vote, it's the younger voters, they're going to pay for them. They're already paying for them with college tuitions skyrocketing and financial aid being massively reduced. So students are already paying for this. Already, and they might not even realize how much cheaper school was just 10 years ago when I went to the University of Illinois and had got so much out of my Pell Grant and other programs like that. And it's going to be even harder on their kids. And so I wish that was a bigger issue for them. And I got the sense that it wasn't. But that the war in Iraq, because I spoke with so many kids, I did a whole half of a chapter on the college convention, and I really hung out looking for the elusive youth vote. And I found that the war in Iraq and the environment are really the bigger issues.
All right. Let's talk with someone here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, actually what happened is that when I did the process of calling in, issue of the environment wasn't raised, and so you pretty much covered that. I was surprised that in terms of why I'm on different mailing lists in terms of for the environment, why collectively a lot of these, you know, like a consortium or some or other, the environment's really taken a beating, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, when Bush first got in office and this, on lead and a bunch of other things. I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, somehow, I guess people don't know or what this means, you know, or what, I mean, the uninformed, what it does, it means in the long run. Or the other point is that they can go and companies, corporations can take these sites and then they walk away and we're stuck with the cleanup.
Right, and they will, and people don't realize, I agree with you 100%, people don't realize that when companies are not regulated, when you don't say to these companies, hey, you cannot destroy the environment, then the companies do destroy the environment. They have in the past. It's well documented that unregulated companies will destroy the environment, and this idea of self-regulation is you know, absurd. We're just killing ourselves. And, and that's a big issue with kids. And I think people know, I think bipartisan, everybody knows that John Kerry is much better on the environment than George Bush. And I say that as a nonpartisan person. But, it doesn't seem to move as many voters as it should. It matters to the kids, but, will they mobilize? The real issue for the kids this year is the Iraq war.
Yeah, the other one that, in terms of the global warming thing, I mean, that's another thing that, you know, is...
Right, and not accepting science, right? Because
right.
You deny the global warming for the first 4 years, meanwhile you make it worse, and you deny stem cell research on the same grounds.
I understand that I read in terms of that may take traction, what do you think, with the Republicans, the stem cell research?
Stem cell research is a winner for Democrats.
You know, it's one of those things where the Republicans are in a bind because of their base. So they're kind of stuck in a position, and also because George Bush is a real hardcore born-again Christian, and you might not agree with his religion, but to think that he doesn't believe this stuff, like a lot of the stuff he does is just policy and it's being influenced by other people, the things that George Bush himself for sure holds true to his heart, which I'm absolutely certain is he is vehemently against a woman's right to choose.
Mm.
He's against stem cell research. He's a creationist, and he really believes that homosexuality is a sin, and he strongly believes in that constitutional amendment. And people, and that's the constitutional amendment thing is not great policy. It's not great politics. Even these are the things that he will not be moved on because he really holds them true to his heart.
But you know whether he certainly had a drinking problem.
Right.
Sometimes in terms of converts, in other words, people whether he was an alcoholic or whatever, sometimes go that other direction too.
Uh huh.
The direction it seems that he's taken.
Right. Yeah. I hear you.
Okay. Good show.
All hey.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call.
Hope to see you tonight.
I wonder, Stephen. Given the fact that you've had the opportunity to see some candidates up close and follow the process, would you ever consider running for office yourself?
I don't think so. I've written all these dark novels about drugs and sex, and I just think that I'd be used against me. I have too long of a track record. I would probably enjoy being involved in the background and organizing a campaign. I don't think I'd enjoy being a candidate.
Hmm.
I see myself more as a James Carville type than a Bill Clinton type.
Hmm. Well, what does it take to be an effective candidate, do you think?
Well, it's so hard to say. People think that John Kerry is not a great candidate because he can come off as very stiff, but he's great at organizing a campaign. He's an incredibly efficient executive and administrator, and that certainly has had, I would say, everything to do with his success so far. He's, also, you look at these guys during the debates, right? The ability to just stand up there and hammer at each other and try not to flinch. Certainly, charisma is, you can't overestimate the importance of charisma, of which John Kerry is kind of lacking and has really hurt his campaign. If John Kerry had John Edwards' charisma, this would be a blowout. It wouldn't even be a close election. And that ability that George Bush has to connect with a small crowd,
mm-hmm.
it's really something to behold. It's really, I didn't think he was so charismatic when I saw him on television, but when I actually started hanging out with him and saw him in a small crowd, he's pretty amazing. He has an amazing ability. For a guy that comes from much more wealth and privilege than John Kerry has played off as the guy who, the Boston Brahmin, the guy raised rich, and people always look at Bush like he was raised in a trailer home. This guy, nobody in America probably came from more privilege than George Bush, but he is able to connect with people who are uneducated and angry and poor and connect with them as if he is one of them. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It defies logic.
Well, that's one. That's the thing that you always hear about George Bush.
Yeah,
and that you see that he's not particularly great in press conferences. He's not particularly a great speech maker.
Mm-hmm.
In those kind of situations, he doesn't do well. But that in this person to person stuff, mm-hmm. he is really good. I mean, that's what I only know that from having read about it. I haven't seen it, but that's always the thing that you have heard about him.
He really connects with poor white anger, and he gets people to vote. He gets poor people to vote in favor of tax cuts for the rich. It's amazing. That the Republicans have brought this coalition of poor white people into the fold. It's hard. I mean, there's a great book on it. What's the Matter with Kansas? But it's really hard to understand. He has people voting against their own self-interest. I mean, there's a lot of people who have good reason to vote Republican and vote for George Bush. But there's a lot of people that don't and are voting for him anyway. And that's really something.
Mm-hmm. Well, that it makes me think about how sometimes when people talk about politics, they fall back on the model of the student council election, and mm-hmm. they ask, well, look at the tendency of Americans. Is the tendency to vote for the guy who is the most likable, or mm-hmm. do you want to vote for the guy who is the smartest?
Mm-hmm.
And it
right.
seems that we're really not quite sure.
Do you want the guy who you want to have a drink with, or do you want the designated driver? You know, who would you rather have, you know, running the country? It's a very strange, it's a strange phenomenon. But also, it's the map seems to change every 4 years. It wasn't that long ago where the mainstream media had a major impact on these things, you know, where the kind of news that has come out about Bush and what's happened in Iraq, the kind of things that have been written about him on the front page of the New York Times would sink a presidency. You know, there's a time when LBJ said, oh, now that I've lost Walter Cronkite, I don't have a chance. When about Vietnam, that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. You know, so it's hard to say. Both sides have created their own pipes and their own pipeline of information. And so what matters and what doesn't gets harder and harder to decipher. And we'll look back and we'll say, well, this matters and that matters, but our information will already be 4 years out of date. Because we take everything from the last election.
Yeah. Well, we're at the point here, I'm sorry, we're going to have to stop. I have to apologize to somebody who just now called in. We're not going to be able to take the call. But for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, I do want to mention one more time that our guest, Stephen Elliott, will be doing a book signing at the Illini Union Bookstore at 6 o'clock tonight. So you can stop by, meet him, pick up a copy of this book that we've mentioned, which is titled Looking Forward to It, the subtitle, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the American Electoral Process. It's published by Picador. Stephen Elliott has written for GQ, Newsweek, Village Voice, San Francisco Chronicle. He's also the author of 4 novels. He teaches at Stanford and now lives in San Francisco, but at the moment is traveling around the country talking about the book. Stephen, thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It was a real pleasure, and I hope to see all these people tonight. We'll get to their questions in the bookstore, I promise.
All right, very good.
Okay.